Hello and welcome to On Geopolitics from the Centre for Geopolitics at University of Cambridge. This is the podcast that looks at geopolitical problems in a historical context with me, Suzanne Rain, and Professor Ali Ansari. But today we're not looking in a historical context at all. We're leaving analogue behind, Ali, and heading into the digital world. We're being joined brilliantly by Kieran Martin, who is Professor at the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford and formerly the founding CEO of the UK's National Cybersecurity Centre. So welcome, Kieran.
Hi, thanks both of you for having me. Great to be here.
Really good to have you here. Let me start you off, Kieran, by asking of a sort of very basic question in a sense. To what extent do you think we can blame technology for many of the ills that our societies are facing at the moment?
Well, I'm a bit worried by Suzanne's introduction because she told me not to put things in an historical context, but I wanted to. So let me, because I think this is really important and it helps in a geopolitical context as well. There's no doubt that when we're all gone in hundreds of years' time, assuming we haven't all been enslaved by killer robots, that when the history of this period is written, there'll be a dramatic sense of societal and economic change driven by tech. There's no doubt about that. So it is genuinely important. At the same time, there are these huge trends that it's very easy to blame if they're negative on tech. And that's not really a sensible way of doing things. I think the most sensible way is to look at global geopolitical and historical trends and say, look, what's different about technology? So I'll give you one thing that is. We have in our societies at the moment, both originating from criminal gangs who are hosted in hostile countries like Russia and from nation states, we have this sort of constant menace that we find it very hard to do something about because the harm to our societies, let's take cybercrime hosted in Russia, where, you know, at the minute there's a big crisis in the US healthcare system because Russian criminals are ransoming it, as they say. There's very little that, you know, if you take historically, a criminal actor starts to have a go at American commercial hospitals, the FBI will be all over it and the American law enforcement system. And they are. The only issue is because these people are remotely hacking from Russia, they can't go after them physically. They just can't. I mean, you think about the geopolitical consequences. If Russia does not cooperate, it doesn't extradite its own citizens. So law enforcement traditionally doesn't work. That's new, and that's due to technology. And the big trend here is for the first time in human history, you can inflict significant harm on another territory without ever setting foot in that territory. You know, even within at the height of international terrorism, you could plop from, you know, remote areas of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, but at the end of the process, somebody somewhere had to set foot in your territory to execute the act, and that no longer happens. So that's a big deal in terms of managing social and digital harm. On the other hand, in terms of some of the things we're planning to talk about in terms of elections, you know, we talk about, oh, we've got these computers now, and so they're undermining our democracy like never before. I mean, that's nonsense. If Britain has a general election in October 2024, and let's face it, the odds are narrowing quite significantly in favour of that, it will be 100 years to the month since the election of October 1924, which was influenced by the Zinoviev letter, you know, what we now call a deep fake. It had no computerised involvement at all. Indeed, at a time when we're all talking about potentially doctored and edited images emerging from the households of the next head of state.
I thought we weren't going to discuss that, Kieran, we're on to it.
Well, you know, people are now harking back to the days when, you know, the Stalinists used to alter photos. You know, there's nothing new about this type of thing. And I think, you know, that's not just a sort of, oh, too clever by half point about fakes. It's also a point about, let's look at all sorts of things, such as the wider polarization in Western society. I think technology is a contributor to that. I mean, you two are much more expert on wider geopolitical and social trends than I would be. But it seems to me a stretch, to put it gently, to blame, for example, the polarization that's very evident in the United States at the minute with Trump and the anti-Trump contingent. It seems to me a stretch to blame all of that on computers and ignoring deep-seated economic trends that have been happening since deindustrialization, et cetera, et cetera. So what's important in technology is working out what's new about it. Where was it the direct cause of new harms? Where is it a contributor and indeed often an accelerator of existing tensions? And where is it just a convenient excuse for things that we don't want to face up to that have got much more complicated roots?
You've made me think while you were talking there, Kieran, I'm about to take us off in a direction that you hadn't expected, I suppose.
Okay, great.
But you just made, as you were talking, I thought if I was sitting there in the Supreme Leader's office in Iran, I would see all of those things as being a problem for me too.
Yes.
Because the way actually that we in the West encourage the use of social media to encourage young people in Iran, Ali Adam, looking at you, to protest, to rise up, we're spreading all of that. You could see that although we see this, we talk about this in terms of the West as the democratic way that we organize ourselves as being under threat by the way that technology is influencing how people think and behave. But actually, if you flip it round, it's probably exactly the same.
Well, they've been complaining about this for long before we have, you'll be pleased to know. I mean, I think Facebook was deemed one of the enemies of the state in Iran about two decades ago, actually, much to a lot of mockery over here. So they're very anxious about it. I mean, you're quite right on that.
So and I think it's a really important point. And I think two of the things we lose sight of, two perspectives we lose sight of. One is how the rest of the world sees technology, and might come back to that. The other is how we used to see technology and how others used to see technology. It's not that long ago, but Ali's already talked a little bit about Iran, and from the little I know about it, I would concur. I know a bit more about how China has historically seen the internet. China was terrified of the internet in the late 90s. That's why I put so much effort into mastering it. I was at a lecture recently in Oxford with an expert on Chinese tech, and it was really insightful. She was going through the history of China's perception of the internet. And when it got to 2013, she did a big thing on Snowden, but in a way that I completely didn't expect. So Snowden is an important landmark in the Chinese view of the internet because they realized, oh my word, we've been so complacent about cyber power. We've been so complacent about, look how open we've been. So Snowden was actually a sort of Sputnik moment in, for better or worse. I'm just saying this is how others see it, because it was a genuine shock to uncover the scale, as they saw it, of Five Eyes digital intelligence gathering and so on. And I think this plays into, the current sort of debates on tech and AI safety and security. I mean, one judgment I think that Rishi Sunak got correct and was very brave to do so was to invite the Chinese to Bletchley Park. It wasn't an easy decision. And it's very difficult to do nuance on China at the moment without appearing soft. But just looking at it objectively, there's no conceivable way that China wants a free-for-all on AI. I mean, I think most Chinese experts would tell you that China is more afraid of the potential downside consequences of AI than we are. and that it's sort of paranoically seeking to master it, to manage it, to gain leadership in it, but it is terrified of the loss of state control over its development. So if you want a truly global deal on AI, and let's face it, if it is deemed to be, although I think, the risks of this are pretty remote, but it's globally important. And if it is deemed to be potentially existential risk, then you need some sort of global agreement, just like you did with other technologies that potentially cause existential risk. And what you have to bear in mind is that then, is this an interlocutor with whom you can have a conversation, or is it somebody whose view of the world is so opposed to you that you can't? And in this case, I think it's the former, because they will not want people going off non-state actors getting their hands on all sorts of powerful AI capabilities and so on. So for better or worse, we can have that conversation. So Sunak was right to make that call.
When I was preparing for this, Kieran, the first question I asked was, who are the bad actors? And this, what you've just said, does make you think about this. And are they states or are they not states? Hmm. And that includes tech companies, obviously. And then you just used a phrase, this is a long question, giving you multiple opportunities to avoid most parts of it. And then the second bit was you used the phrase to master it, to gain leadership of it. And that's the kind of arms race discussion, isn't it? Who wins this? So actually two questions. Who are the bad actors? And we can go off in lots of different directions about that. But then how does this competition play into that geopolitical competition that we've also got?
So I might answer that in reverse order, because I think it's one of the biggest shifts in recent years that it's important to get right. The whole point about the arms race and mastering it and gaining leadership in it, I think comes from the historical context from the 90s, the holiday from history between the fall of the Berlin Wall and 9/11. That's when the technology we're all using really gained ground. And it was fundamentally American, non-governmental. It was the American private sector. Sure, we had Tim Berners-Lee, you had a bit of the US government, et cetera, but primarily the American private sector built a model of a free and open internet with minimal government interference. And at that sort of arrogant point in history, we all assumed that that was the only model it was ever going to be. I think the bad actors that we've talked about are cheats on that internet. but it's a single model. And this is where the difference between, say, Russia and China, if you're looking at it from a Western perspective, this is the difference between Russia and China. Russia is just a very sophisticated cheat on America's internet. China pursued its own operations on America's internet, you know, stole lots of data, et cetera, et cetera. But unlike Russia, then decided to contest the economic model and build its own. You know, Russia doesn't have a technological industrial base to speak of. China absolutely does, and it works very differently. And they're contesting and competing. And that's why, you know, I mean, in a sense, cybersecurity, my field, went from being very nonpartisan and apolitical. It was just, can you keep, you know, your branch of America's internet as safe as possible? To, you know, now you have the US and China sanctioning each other, you know, restricting access to materials, to microchips. People are talking about undersea cable security. People are talking about where the location of data centers, all of this stuff, you know, the supply of rare earth materials needed for batteries and all of that. So there's now a sort of battle for economic leadership of technology and also the model, you know, these obscure standards bodies that set the rules for how computers operate with each other and so forth. You know, China and Chinese companies are now putting forward these proposals that would make it easier for state surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a different model. But in terms of who are the baddies, that's still, you know, and having perhaps in the last answer, you know, tried to give an account of how, for example, China, and we were talking about Iran, see the world. I mean, this is an unashamedly an unambiguously Western answer, because that's what I know. But in terms of, you know, the computer network, the traditional computer network security threat to the US-based internet that we in the UK and in Europe and so on still use, it's largely states and criminals. So we did worry about cyber terrorism. The thing about terrorists is that having a large-scale hostile hacking operation leaves quite a big footprint. And terrorist groups are trying not to leave a footprint so that the US-led opponents of them cannot find them. So you need a sort of, you know, frankly, a cyber command, a GCHQ, you know, an FSB Unit 16 type operation. So you need a building, you need somewhere for people to go, you need staff, you need digital infrastructure. And a terrorist group can't build all that because obviously it just makes it a sitting target. So you have hostile nation states. You've got the four that the West have worried about for the last 10 years have been Russia for geopolitical reasons, China for espionage reasons, although the US are now saying it's also for disruptive reasons, Iran and North Korea. And then you've had the cyber criminal gangs, who have been the ones that have actually caused the most high profile and dangerous harm. Because, you know, the nation states tend to act with some type of restraint, not always. So Russia and North Korea have both got operations spectacularly wrong that have caused all sorts of damage. But the criminals don't care. So, you know, it is highly unlikely, say, that the Russian state, even at its worst, is going to hack a Western hospital and ask for money. But the criminals do. And one of the other misunderstandings about cyber is that, you know, a cyber attack can take planes out of the sky and that sort of thing. It's not really how it works.
Right.
You know, if you're in Britain, you may remember last August, the air traffic control system failed comprehensively. You know, it was an accident. There were no, but that doesn't matter if you're in a plane. If the computers go down, the computers go down. But the planes all landed safely because no air traffic control system, we will all be relieved to know, relies entirely on the maintenance of the computer network because they fail all the time. So we have backups and we land them.
Kieran, can I interrupt you there just to say, because one of the things that I'm fascinated by, because you see the difficulties this poses for news organizations at that level, is attribution.
Yes.
And obviously, anytime there's a terrorist attack, there's a sort of tail where people want, the first thing they want to know is who's done it and how long, you know, is it finished? And that's the thing that nobody knows because you've just been surprised by something. And so you end up with this division, essentially, between 24/7 news coverage, which needs to talk about it, and the people who need to decide what to do, who are sitting somewhere else saying, we haven't got a clue what's happened yet, so give us a bit of time. And what you're talking about there is a sort of really neat and obvious example where suddenly the air traffic control goes down and everyone goes berserk saying, oh, someone's hacked, we're all going to die. And that question then of attributing of, say, and I watch you on Twitter where you're a model of this, but of saying, well, let's just wait, let's see what's happened. So there's a whole industry out there now, isn't there, Kieran, of kind of cyber attributors who are trying to, in a way, perform a function of steadying our nerves, where they're allowing time for this properly to be understood. Is that what's going on?
It's a hard problem. So I think when you attribute, you're asking two questions. One is, who did it? And the second is, what is the relationship with the state that they did it from? And that both are quite important and both can be quite difficult. So the who did it is often a technical and intelligence gathering question.
And in the course of my government career, and I ran country cyber operations for the UK government for 6.5 years, attribution ranged from everything from having video footage of people under surveillance typing into a keyboard, and you know, seeing exactly who they were, where they were and what they were doing, all the way through to not being entirely sure what continent it came from and everything in between. So there's a big range of levels of confidence in terms of what you know. Then the second question, let's take the upper end of that scale where you absolutely do know who's doing it and so forth. There's the question of what their relationship is with the state. So, you know, we talked about states and criminals being the main actors. So, you know, China and Russia both have uniformed military personnel who go into an office building every day and, you know, they get issued orders just like other military and intelligence personnel and they carry them out. And that's 100% controlled by the state. There are, although there's not that many examples of this, but at the other extreme, there are countries who are, you know, weak central governments who are trying very hard to eject cyber criminals from their territory and not having much success. But you don't go around blaming them for the harm that they're doing. You try and build capacity. The really difficult bit is these sort of semi-state actors. So, for example, there's just been a rather amusing leak of a Chinese semi-state actor called Isun. You know, the cybersecurity industry loves to give people these ridiculous code names. And Isun sells to the Ministry of State Security. So it hacks. It tries to hack things. It tries not to get caught, which is why this leak has been rather damaging, not least because it shows just how tawdry and badly run Isun is. And then, you know, it says to the Ministry of State Security, we've got into this foreign ministry, you know, would you like to buy it from us? And there's a certain deniability about that, although not for ISIS anymore, thanks to these leaks. So that's one example of semi-state activity. Iran is another good example where there's lots of sort of entrepreneurial hackers who then go to the state and say, interested in this? And so forth. They get swiftly disowned if they cause any embarrassment. And then the relationship between criminal actors and the Russian state is absolutely fascinating. And the best example of this, to pick up from the last answer, you know, they've caused the most harms because they can't take planes out of the sky and they can't switch off, say, hospital operating theatres. They can stop people being admitted to hospital. They can cause the large-scale postponement of diagnostic consultations, so they can cause serious harm. And that's what happened, say, at national level. That's what happened in Ireland in 2021. So in Ireland, there's this body called the Health Services Executive. And for a British audience, think of it like the commissioning wing of the NHS. So it says, here's where you're having your appointment, et cetera, et cetera. And that it was a single computer system and it was out of date and it got completely done over. So the whole national appointments booking system didn't work. It was a disaster. It quickly became clear that this was an attack from within Russia, really obvious for reasons I won't go into in the interest of time. So then you have, now Ireland's not in NATO, but it is in the EU. If you actually seriously thought that this was a directly ordered Kremlin hit on an EU member state, you'd be in some pretty interesting geopolitical territory. If you then thought that, you know, this was something the Russians were actively trying to stop, you'd be wrong, because they're not. So it's that somewhere in between where it's like, and actually there was a lot of diplomats, this is before the invasion of Ukraine, where there was some semblance of dialogue with Russia, which could occasionally be sensible. There was a push to say, look, you cannot go around hosting people who will ransom and hijack an entire national healthcare system. And for a while before the invasion, there was a little bit of a squeeze put in these gangs. So that attribution is really complicated. Who did it? But then, which is frankly a technical and intelligence judgment, a very sort of professional one. And then there's, what is their relationship to the state, which can be really, really murky and is a judgment call for governments.
And it's deliberately murky, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The other thing, Kieran, that this has done, sorry, this is not the direction, again, that I expected, but it's shifted the balance of knowledge from the oldest people in governments, in structures and decision-making, to some of the youngest, because they're the ones who can do the really techie stuff in the background that can tell you what's actually happened on the computers. And I wondered, I mean, obviously, you bridged both those divides so magnificently. But I think there's something really interesting about the way that it's changed the structures of understanding and knowledge in governments, because it's been necessary to broaden the conversation to include far more people, because they're the ones who actually know what's going on the internet. Is that correct? Or do you think it hasn't?
I think there's a lot in it. I think who knows whether the passage of time will take care of it. I mean, you know, I was in the civil service when, you know, mass use of email came along, and I worked for people who, you know, struggled to adapt to that. But nowadays, you know, I mean, as we now know, government can be occasionally run by WhatsApp, and you know, there's no sense of that. But it's a really interesting point. I think it does affect the power dynamics sometimes. So, you know, when I was running the National Cybersecurity Center, I think techies who tended to be young, not all of them were, but techies who could, communicate very clearly and in very accessible ways were extraordinarily valuable. And, even things, and I know this is very down in the weeds, but, I remember just you'd fight with, the powers that be to say, you'd have a meeting with the Prime Minister. We shouldn't have that often, but, you'd have a meeting with the Prime Minister and you'd say, look, can we please bring this young technical expert? Mm-hmm. Because what's the point in me spending hours and then maybe not knowing the answer to a question? We'll control him or her, but, at the end of the day, if we have to explain some complicated software engineering, it's probably better if you have somebody who's actually really, really deeply qualified in the subject. And over time, I recall a rather hilarious conversation with a Singaporean colleague about the cryptographic security for the contact tracing app during the pandemic, because the problem for this poor sod was that the Prime Minister of Singapore is one of the most distinguished cryptographers of the last 50 years that's ever passed through Harvard. So, we were talking about this problem, and he was laughing because he had to go on a whiteboard with equations and so forth. But that's the exception rather than the rule. But, as a new generation of digital natives spring up, maybe that will abate. I also think that, you've got your classic problem again, linking it to some of the examples of COVID. There's nothing about technological politics that requires you to spend wider judgment. But, it's quite difficult for politicians sometimes to be seen to go against the technological advice because, do they understand it? On the other side, it can be sometimes quite difficult, and we saw this a lot in the early days of the China tech debates. Technology isn't magic and it's not capable of magic. So on the one hand, things that sound very scary, this has come from China, but then they can actually do magic. But then you might think about geopolitical dependence. And those discussions in the early stages were quite tricky.
That's one of the interesting things. I mean, something that you said earlier and also Suzanne said about the way in which technology accelerates. In a sense, we've had misinformation, but misinformation can be accelerated. But I think that point about magic is an important one because, one of the things that we have, of course, is that for most ordinary people, technology on this sort of scale is completely incomprehensible. I mean, it is magic. It is magic for our modern age in some ways. And because of that distrust, what you're getting in a sense was, what I'm thinking is that you could have an attack. The attack could be, in your own view, fairly a non-event in some ways. But the way in which the pundits on social media suddenly sort of get very, hyperventilate over something and exaggerate it could actually in some ways magnify the problem.
I think that's right. And I think, it'll be 10 years, another 10-year anniversary in October this year. It'll be the 10th anniversary of the TalkTalk hack. And TalkTalk, for those who remember it, was the first cyber incident to leave the British news.
Right.
And it was a good example of what you're talking about because, as it turned out, it turned the crisis playbook on its head for cyber because, I think the chief executive, Dido Harding, did all the right things at the time and was sort of keen to be out and transparent, but inadvertently made it sound way worse than it actually was. It was actually, I remember living through the news that weekend, was one of the reasons why a national incident function was established in the National Cybersecurity Center was so you give clear objective, like in climate, as Suzanne was saying, when a bomb goes off, you get a clear assessment from the government of what they know and so on. We didn't have that for cyber. And so in that weekend in late October 2014, if you listen to the news, TalkTalk had 4 million customers and you'd be forgiven for thinking all of them were at risk of having their bank accounts emptied. Mm. It was never close to that. It was 150,000 out-of-date records from the acquisition of Tiscali 7 or 8 years earlier. And we just hadn't quite got that message out. So there's real risk of that, I think. But my plea there, there is something here about the responsibility of decision takers. It comes back to Suzanne's last question. I have been, I used to joke with colleagues about this, when I was waiting for my item, say the National Security Council or something, you'd have various politicians of all shapes and stripes who would quite happily proffer their opinion on aircraft carrier procurement. They had no background in aircraft carrier procurement, but they would say something and maybe it would make sense, maybe it didn't. But when it came to computer network security, it was like, oh, well, it's way too complicated. Let us into the experts. And that's quite a dangerous thing. If you suspend critical faculties, I used to tease energy companies when they would say, can you come and give us talk to our board about cybersecurity? And they'd say, it's much too complicated for us. I'd say, your core business is extracting fossil fuels from the seabed economically and safely. That sounds quite complicated to me. And you wouldn't have a board member in a PLC saying pension liabilities, can't be doing that. It's too complicated. It's not rocket science. I mean, it really, really isn't. And I think with the dawn of the age of AI, we really need to watch this. There was this comical but also serious incident last May when a US military officer came to London to give a talk at a conference, and it was written up and went all over the world. All it was in the Washington Post, it was on Australian TV, it was all over the place, saying that in a US military exercise, an AI drone had killed its human operative because the human operator was trying to stop it from carrying out its evil mission. Now, for those of us who sort of studied this, we were thinking, gosh, AI has come on a lot in the last week or so, and we were deeply, deeply worried that we'd got this completely wrong. Within the next 12 hours, there were a series of spectacular, I think the media term for it is clarifications. There were three. The second and third came in the middle of the night, but the first one was the best. It said, we have added quotation marks around kill and killed in this story to make it clear that no actual human being was harmed in this and it was in a simulation. You're like, well, that's a pretty important clarification. My point there is not to tell a funny story, although it is, I do find it quite entertaining. It's that even at the height of COVID panic and so forth, I don't think the mainstream global media were ever as gullible over something to do with COVID as they were with, or any, you know, in what other field of human activity would, you know, serious news outlets just say, oh, okay, you know, let's report that an AI drone has killed its human operator, despite the fact that is so far off the scale of where expert understanding was. So I do think we need to, you know, the most dangerous thing, whether it's corporate decision-taking, political decision-taking, is a bunch of people sitting around a table listening to young experts or old experts and so on and just saying and nodding because they're too scared to look embarrassed by saying they don't really understand what they're being told. If you don't really understand what you're being told and you're in a position of responsibility, just say you don't understand it and ask them to explain it and don't let them go until you have explained it, because it's not magic. You will find a way of understanding it, and you have the responsibility to take an informed decision just like you would, whether it's pension liabilities, a military threat, whatever it is, just understand it.
So that's a fantastic introduction, Kieran, to more of a conversation about democracy and vulnerabilities. So we talk about threats and then we look at ourselves and say, where are we vulnerable to threats? And obviously there's the, you know, large scale attacks like the one on the British Library, which has had a huge impact actually on academics, because it's closed down far more than you expect because of the amount of networking of book reservoirs or whatever they are. So I know that's not the technical term for but
yeah, not reservoirs.
Reservoirs. Sorry. But I mean, that's it's a fascinating example actually where we were very vulnerable. And not only did we not really understand the extent of that vulnerability as a wider group of people, but actually, for weird reasons, that didn't get the coverage that you'd have expected. And it took about a month before everyone really started saying, something's really wrong at the British Library. So there's that. And then this broader question about our societies being vulnerable to this sort of chaotic feeding frenzy that starts whenever somebody mentions cyber and AI.
Yeah, I think so. Two things there. One, the British Library, I think, shows a set of vulnerabilities that are important but are quite hard to capture. So if you think back, and you know, you and I will have done this in the past when you're doing sort of national risk assessments and stuff like that. When you're sitting doing that abstract exercise, the British Library is nobody's idea of first order critical national infrastructure. Mm. But when it goes down, it's really, really painful. But it's quite hard to protect. It's quite hard to give it the budget that it would need to be able to do that. And actually, there's an interesting, slightly niche, but again, you know, pursuant to the last exchange, I think it's important for people to understand this. You know, the Americans in February changed their long-term assessment of the Chinese cyber threat. They said, you know, China, again, it's hard to be nuanced about China, but China has no history of disruptive hacking in the way that Russia does. It hasn't taken out TV stations. It hasn't disrupted the opening ceremony of the Olympics and so on. But the US claimed to have found a whole bunch of implants in US critical infrastructure, aviation, energy, healthcare, coming from a Chinese group that wasn't there for spying. And I would call this, think of ransomware without the ransom. So think about doing 100 operations like the British Library, but instead of offering a way out to, you know, buying your way out of trouble, which is what the criminals do, you just say, no, we're just leaving them there. So you can see the potential for, you know, Jen Easterly, who runs US cyber agency, said, you know, the risk she's warning of is a sort of everything, everywhere, all at once disruption of society, not where people start, you know, losing their lives, but where, you know, wholesale disruption of everyday life occurs in a way that damages confidence. So that's the one thing. I think the second thing then around, you know, elections, democracy and so on, I think the correct word, and, you know, LA has highlighted this, the correct word here is accelerate. You know, there are existing problems and vulnerabilities, always have been. You come back to Zinoviev, come back to, you know, other times when we've been deeply divided and so forth. But there's a serious structural issue now that's going to, looks like it's going to get at least temporarily worse around trust and information, you know, about what is authentic and what is not. You know, I find the whole Imran Khan, you know, authorized fake video quite interesting. I've tried to find an objection to it, and in some respects I can't, because they were pretending it was genuine. Everybody knows the man's in prison, so he's not going to fake this. So, you know, so, but it, I find it really interesting. It's like, you know, we are using it fake to show you what he would have said if he'd been at liberty to do so, you know. So we're in a new dispensation when it comes to trust and information. I do worry about that. You know, I sometimes get accused of being a bit sort of complacent and overly optimistic about our ability to manage threats. I think trying to find a way of restoring trust and information, finding methods of trust and information, is a really big deal. And then there are another bunch of, you know, if you're interested in, you know, protecting democracy, there's a whole bunch of other quite technical and technocratic things, but how does the electoral system work? Where are its vulnerabilities? So how could you get at them? Which, you know, governments are paying lots of attention to. But then, of course, there's a whole bunch of wider things about, you know, our societies are, you know, quite strained at the minute for all sorts of reasons. Technology does exacerbate it, but as I said earlier, it's a stretch to say that it causes it.
Ali, did you want to ask something?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask something on a slightly different angle, but it's also really about, you know, in terms of hackers and in terms of our vulnerability to sort of being hacked, is this something that we just have to basically live with? Is it a situation where the hacker will always get through in that sense? You know, like we used to worry in the 30s about the bomber always getting through. I mean, the point is this something we can ever be absolutely protected from, or is it something we just going to have to live
with? Not absolutely. Certainly in the immediate future. I do think things are changing a little bit in that there's a well-known phrase in my trade that, you know, the internet was built without security in mind. And I think that's true. And it wasn't willful. Yeah. It was just, you know, it was partly the economic drivers at the time, partly the way the tech worked and so on. And, you know, the first sort of mass use version of internet-based technology was give away lots of personal data in return for free access to web-based services. And every word of that is a security disaster. But the economics of the internet are changing. You know, we pay for a lot more services, actually hardware, you know, we've all got devices in our pockets or bags or whatever. Maybe wearing internet-enabled watches. That hardware aspect makes it easier to secure in some respects if you get it right. The US published a national cybersecurity strategy in March of 2023. Which tackles the extraordinarily difficult but crucial task of how to fix software. Because the whole software economy is full of holes. And, you know, there are various, like there's a big hack last year where hundreds, if not more than 1,000 global corporations, I mean the BBC, British Airways and Boots were the three high profile ones in the UK, all got done over because they were all using this core piece of internet software to move data around. And so, you know, you could argue it wasn't really their fault and we should be moving the liability further up the food chain. And that's sort of where we're going now. And I think now that technology is changing, we can see the way that things are going, we have a chance to try to rectify some of these challenges. So, you know, we all talk about quantum computing. I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert in quantum computing. But, you know, we can see, unlike internet-based technology, with quantum computing, we have the luxury of foreseeing its introduction. So we can have a discussion domestically and internationally about how to manage that. And we would be crazy to allow quantum computing to come in, just like with internet-based technology, without some rules and, you know, industry standards about how to make the new quantum material secure. In actual fact, I think we're actually doing that sort of approach without realizing it. So, you know, one of my favorite things is to go back in time and look at newspaper and other papers from 10 years ago about predictions of cybersecurity. So 10 years ago, predictions were the IoT explosion will make everything so much less safe. Well, actually, IoT has made the internet and internet-based technologies a little bit safer. By 2024, there will be no drivers left on the roads because we'll all be in driverless cars. Well, it is 2024 and there are loads of drivers left on the roads. And that's not because we haven't invented driverless technology. We've all know that driverless cars exist. It's because we haven't got the safety model right. So we're just saying, well, you know, at the minute, certainly in this country, the assessment is for driverless cars to work, you need to have a qualified driver ready to take the wheel. That qualified driver needs to be sober, awake, not watching sport or whatever, not working. So in other words, what's the point of having the driverless car? That, in my view, is a good thing. We're being more sensible about the introduction of technology. It's easier to think of, to envisage when you've got human safety at risk, as in the driverless car example. Let's do that for quantum computing. Let's do it for data security. We just don't let technologies into the ecosystem until we're ready to secure them. So I think in time, then, you know, will we ever have a system where it's impossible to misuse technology? No, absolutely not, because the only way of doing that is to close it down or make it unusable. But we can, if we get policy choices right and so on, we can make technology safer by default. I have no doubt about that.
I'm just going to howl into the ether about one of the reasons that driverless cars might not take off is that sometimes people enjoy driving. And there's a bit of me that says, who is inventing all this stuff that we just don't need when we're also trying to save the world from, you know, overconsumption, all the rest of it, and we should just...
Well, there is something in that.
You know, Wi-Fi
on planes is my particular bugbear. You know, it's the last
refuge. Your last refuge when you don't have any internet connectivity.
And there is actually, you know, I do think this goes back to the hype point. I often find that, you know, you find some new use of technology and so forth. You know, again, going back in time, look at when we were tearing ourselves to pieces over, you know, Huawei and 5G and so forth. That was all predicated on warnings about by 2024, you know, we'll be dependent on absolutely everything for 5G. I mean, the main difference 5G has made to my life is that when I'm walking down the street, I can watch live sport, which is probably a stupid thing to do. I mean, there are obviously more profound things than that. But I do sometimes find, you know, yeah, I can watch live sport from Australia while walking down the street, but we still haven't got a cure for cancer, you know, I sometimes subscribe to what some people call the "dude, where's my flying car" school of technology. You know, there's quite a lot of things we haven't achieved. You know, anyway.
So I think we've only got a few minutes left. I wanted to just mention money and efficiency. I mean, I was in a meeting yesterday where it's clear that the budget for IT is taking over the organization in one way or another, plus the budget for defending IT, plus then a whole separate set of conversations about ensuring your IT and your, you know, and then you magnify that to nation state levels. And what you're talking about, I mean, in the UK, in the US, the expenditure on all of this is massive. And you might argue, well, that's countered by the profits that come from it. But are we as the West being efficient? Or are we just spending a huge amount of money on technology, only some of which is money well spent?
That's a really, really interesting question. Certainly in security, the way markets have functioned has been a really important driver of insecurity. So there are parts of our tech defenses that the market looks after brilliantly. So threat intelligence is a classic. If you really want to, you know, if you really want to invest in, if you feel like a high-risk organization, there are all sorts of really good companies competing with each other, gathering loads of information. Historically, if you want to do something like protect your brand from being spoofed, nobody was doing that because you didn't really suffer if your brand was spoofed. You know, if you got a fake email from your favorite supermarket, you didn't blame your favorite supermarket, so people weren't doing that. But obviously, that causes big social harm. Similarly, I think that, you know, the way in which we've regulated some of this stuff been very detrimental to security. So telecoms is a classic, you know, one of the, and the UK, I think, has done some very clever policy measures culminating in an act of parliament in 2022 to try to rectify this. But we've ended up with 20 years of telecoms regulation that was obsessed with as low consumer prices as possible. And when we were members of the EU, no roaming charges with other countries. And you ended up then with quite weak security in the telecoms infrastructure because nobody had an incentive to invest in it. And you also ended up with a collapsing market and telecoms infrastructure, which is why that became the big sort of fulcrum of contestation with China. So I don't honestly have a view as to whether, you know, we're spending money efficiently or so forth, you know, at a sort of macro level on IT. I mean, we are spending an absolute fortune on it. You know, I think some of the digital government stuff that was involved with peripherally and post-2010 period in the UK was actually quite useful in enhancing citizen experience and saving money at a time when there was very little of it about post-crash. But I do think, you know, the strategic management of tech infrastructure I think we're finding it quite hard to, because when we leave that to the market, which is what we do, it ends up with all sorts of weird and distorted outcomes, both for security and also in terms of, you know, resilience of supply that we haven't quite got our head around how to deal with yet.
That's fascinating. That's a whole nother conversation, isn't it? Because
it is. There is a lot more to talk about, to be honest, but hopefully we might get you back, Kira. But,
and that's completely fascinating though, because what you're finishing up by arguing is for, are you arguing for greater, I don't want to say state control, but states planning of infrastructure systems?
So now that I'm out of government, I am, you know, a bit less careful sometimes about what I say. And that's a very, very good question that if, you know, I was back in government and I was on the Today program, I'd be terrified of answering. I think we need to have, and I'm sorry to be so sort of pusillanimous in my phrasing here, I think we need to have a sort of serious grown-up conversation about it to see what is possible. So at the moment, I think, and this comes back to the US-China, you know, China versus the West sort of struggle on tech. At the moment, we're overlaying sort of traditional national security cooperative frameworks on what's essentially an economics issue. So, you know, my favorite example of that is when we were going through the whole, you know, 5G rise with the Americans and all our Five Eyes partners. You know, as we were trying to sort of work our way out of this, I remember, you know, people giving us, giving me, you know, who ran a subsidiary of GCHQ, you know, instructions to say, you know, you need to go and work more closely with our Five Eyes partners to build alternatives to the Chinese giants. And saying that's the wrong bit of government to be talking to. You know, I'm a cybersecurity subset of a signals intelligence agency. We don't build alternatives to Huawei. And actually, we have got used to, in my view, and I'm sure there are military people who be listening to this, who'll be spitting into their tea, whatever, when I say this, but, you know, conceptually and even practically, defense cooperation is easy. You know, you've got defense ministries, they're used to collaborating with each other. If you're in NATO, they've got a big bureaucracy in Brussels. And kind of you've got one trade-off. You've got sovereignty versus interoperability. How much you want to be able to do on your own versus how much you want to be able to do with allies. That's kind of it. All sorts of technical and budgetary complexities within that, but it's kind of it. And we know how to do defense cooperation. If you want to say, for the next generation of telecoms and internet infrastructure, we want to make sure that there's a robust, not completely US-dominated, but friendly Western alliance industrial base. That means that Western countries aren't reliant on Chinese alternatives, and indeed Western tech is better than China. How do you do that? And actually, the Prime Minister, when he was campaigning for the leadership, once made reference to the idea of a technological NATO. I think that's a really interesting idea. It's very good. But I think the challenge with the technological NATO concept is it sounds easy. It's really not. It's massively hard. You look at what President Biden's doing with the CHIPS Act and so forth. You can see the strategic play against China. But then he enrages most of America's allies by saying, and the answer is $52 billion of subsidies to the state of Ohio. Right. So this is a really, really hard problem. And so am I arguing for greater state oversight of this? I guess I kind of am, but I'm saying we may not be able to do it. It certainly needs, we need to find different ways, you know, without killing the innovation goose and the free market goose that laid all these eggs in the first place. We need to find different ways, and we need to realize this is really hard. And you don't just say, oh, let's work with Five Eyes or let's, you know, do this, because it involves us cooperating in areas where we normally friendly and lawfully compete. It involves us doing things differently.
Thank you. We're going to end there, but that is a vision for the future. You heard it here first, everybody. I think that's fantastic, Kieran. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Explaining some stuff, but also giving us new ways of looking at things is terrific. So thank you.
And thank you from me.